Hey, before we get started here, if you are a repeat listener, can you do me a quick favor and rate and review the show right now? We're really making a push to get great guests on the show, and your reviews help us attract the very best guests. So if you could do that, I would really appreciate it. Now let's dive into the show.
We look at the market first. Where is it located? Is it in a growing submarket of one of the major MSAs in the Southeast, Texas, Colorado, Arizona? That's where we want to be. We want to be where people are moving to. We don't want to be where people are exiting from. And so market first.
Hey guys, David Robinson here. Welcome to the Lead Sponsor Podcast. Today's guest is the managing partner at PassiveInvesting.com for self-storage. He leads the deal sourcing, broker relations, and overall strategy for their self-storage investment funds. He graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, where he served as a fund manager for the university's private equity real estate fund, and he currently resides in Charlotte, North Carolina. In the last 18 months, they have acquired 9 self-storage facilities, about 4,500 total units, valuing roughly $90 million in value, and really enjoyed our conversation with Chris Bennett today. We talked about how he got started in the space. We talked about his thoughts on going more of a traditional route to breaking into the private equity, commercial real estate investing, real estate syndication space, like he did, going more of a traditional route, going to college, getting a degree, getting a entry-level position at a private equity fund, eventually growing in that role, and eventually exiting and going off on his own, versus taking more of an entrepreneurial route and being self-taught, diving right in, having some challenges early on, and then eventually growing in your role to be a successful investor yourself. So we talk about the pros and cons of sort of both paths if you are new to this space and are trying to break in. I think that conversation will be helpful to you. We also talk about his transition from multifamily into self-storage. He actually started out on the multifamily side of the business, sourcing deals for the private equity fund, and then eventually transitioned to self-storage and focused exclusively on that, and how he partnered with PassiveInvesting.com and Dan Hanford, who has been a previous guest on the show, and how together they've acquired 9 assets, 4,500 units, and $90 million of self-storage in the last roughly 18 months or so. We also talk about the top 3 metrics he uses to identify good self-storage opportunities, which I think you will appreciate. So I really enjoyed my conversation with Chris Bennett today. And without further ado, let's get into the show. Mr. Chris Bennett, welcome to the show. Appreciate you coming on.
David, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So I've already given the listeners a little bit of a background on yourself and your role over at PassiveInvesting.com. But if you don't mind, let's back up. Let's talk a little bit about your past professional experience, and then sure, how you got into the self-storage space and also working with PassiveInvesting.com.
Great. Yeah, no problem. So I got my real estate license back in 2007. My first day on the job as a residential broker was August 20th. So that anniversary is coming up as of this recording. And 2007. So we thought we're all going to be rich. There was like my real estate class was like completely packed with people ready to become brokers and go out there and crush it. And little did we know that the Great Recession was happening, was going to happen. It was actually already happening, but was going to happen in 2008 and 2009. So that was a really huge learning experience for me. I worked with asset managers and banks on the foreclosure side of the business. And when I say worked with them, I meaning I worked at a firm that relisted their properties for sale after they foreclosed. So oftentimes I would go out and actually like with the sheriff's deputy and evict people and change locks on doors and button up the property. Now it belongs to the bank. And we go back and do a little BPO or a little valuation, and the bank would relist the property with us for sale later on. And I worked with investors to purchase homes cash. Little did I know that I should have been buying all those properties back then. But hey, when you first start out, you're kind of drinking from a fire hose as it is. So fast forward, actually, because of that experience and seeing how bad it was, evicting people and all that, I had some really bad experiences. But I decided that real estate wasn't for me. I went on to get my education and go to college, and I went to UNC Chapel Hill And lo and behold, the only job I could find my first summer there was working for a real estate private equity shop that syndicated equity to purchase multifamily properties. So as fate would have it, I ended up working for him and underwrote a bunch of stuff over the summer and then worked for him for two summers in a row and really learned during that time that, oh my gosh, this is how you purchase commercial real estate, like multifamily. You can buy 200 doors at one time versus 200 single family homes, right? And have it all in one place, you know, so on and so forth. So I realized this is the way to be. This is where I want to be. So I worked, I'm making a long story short here. There's a real estate private equity fund at UNC Chapel Hill. And I was, I made it to the fund. I was a fund manager. We actually handled real LP capital, invested in all kinds of asset classes, multifamily, storage, hotel, hospitality, et cetera, retail, you know, you name it. We were looking at it. And invested LP equity. That opened a door for me to be director of acquisitions at a firm in Raleigh, focused on multifamily acquisitions. And we pivoted to storage during that time. And we could talk about the reasons why, et cetera. But I found out that, hey, I love storage and the operations of the business, and this is where I want to be. So that's what happened. And I moved to Charlotte about a year or two, about 2 years after graduating from school, partnered up with John Allen, who co-leads the storage side of passiveinvesting.com with me. I knew Dan, Dan Hanford, one of the principals at passiveinvesting.com. And before he started, really, as he was just starting in multifamily, he invited me to a meetup. And I said, I don't know how I know Dan, but I'll just go anyway. So I went to Charlotte and I went to downtown Charlotte. We met up and we kept the relationship going. And then he contacted me about, I don't know, it's almost been 2 years now, but about a year and a half ago, and said, hey, we want to get into storage. What are you doing? What are you up to? And we formed a partnership from there. So that is the story in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, I want to dive into a few pieces of that. First off, I want to go back to, you know, this, the college education and then your experience in working with a private equity fund. For those listeners that may be younger and wanting to break into the space, do you feel like your experience working for a larger syndication fund and in the private equity space as a fund manager was valuable to your progression as a principal in the commercial real estate investing space? Do you feel like it was beneficial? I'm assuming it was, but what I'm really trying to get at is, do you feel like that is a good path to go down? College, getting in with a firm that's already established, doing deals, learning bits and pieces of the full deal, and then going off on your own? Or in hindsight, would you say, you know what, I could have figured this out. I wish I would have just dove right in and got after it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I have a contrarian view to a lot of the Grant Cardones and the ones out there who, the Gary Vaynerchuks, who say college is a waste of time. I do think it's a waste of time if you're going for the wrong. So just as a big picture, kind of 30,000, then we'll get into the to what you asked. So to answer your question quickly, yes, it had a huge impact on the doors that open up, et cetera, and the connections that you make and all that. But we can get to that in a second. So, but at a high level, if you're going to a university or a college that is not, that is maybe a lower tier or whatever, and it depends on the degree that you're interested in. If you're going for, you know, maybe it's like English or something like that, I'm just going to be straightforward. You probably don't need to spend a bunch of money going to a private Ivy League type school, like Duke. I hate Duke. So like going to Duke, you know, like going to Duke University or whatever. So it really depends on what you want to do, where you kind of see your path going. And that can change. When you're young, you're in your 20s, you don't always know where it's going to end up, right? You might go and get the degree and go do that line of work, or you might end up pivoting in 5 years and doing something completely different that has nothing to do with your degree. And you hear a lot of those stories online. Oh, my degree is useless. It doesn't, whatever. There are still a lot of employment opportunities and jobs that require, it's a barrier to entry. They require a four-year degree. And people who don't have them will often look down on those. Oh, yeah, that's a dumb corporate job. I don't want that. Understandably. So I get that. So it really depends on what you want to do, what kind of school you're going to do it, and kind of connecting the dots from there. Generally speaking, most of us are just well off. If you want to go to college, your parents are pushing you to go to college. You're just as well off going to the local state college that has cheaper tuition or going to the community college, getting your 2-year associates. That's exactly what I did. I got my 2-year associates and then transferred. you save a buttload of money doing it that way. And you're pretty much ready to go once you jump in at the four-year university. So there's a couple of different paths you can go down to get there. I think if you were to kind of boil it down again to just real estate, there are, and this is going to sound the way it is, like snooty or whatever. There are different tiers of schools, and there's a reason why the top 10 or the top 20 business schools out there are the top 10 or the top 20. One is academic rigor, and two is the alumni network and the employers that come to recruit from those schools. So a good example is I live in Charlotte. UNC Charlotte is right here, like 20 minutes away from where I live. UNC Chapel Hill is 2 hours. We moved our whole family there for me to go to school there versus UNC Charlotte. If you look on the career services page at any university that you want to go to, look and see who is coming to recruit at your school for whatever job you want to get into or profession or whatever. There are employers that will not go to UNC Charlotte, but they will go to UNC Chapel Hill or Duke or wherever, NC State, to recruit for a very, you know, entry-level type position. They consider pedigree and your background and where you got your degree from to be very important within their line of work. So that's going to sound however it sounds, and it is what it is. And if you're going to a school that's not in the top 50 or something like that, and I don't mean to, you know, it is what it is. That's life. That's the way it is. Yeah. So now to real estate with the fund and everything, I think times have changed. And so when I got into the business, I graduated 2016, went to work for the company. I was director of acquisitions, fancy title for Bird Dog, just go find deals, right? The background I had opened the door for that role. I had had hands-on experience at Chapel Hill, was able to use that in my role at my next company. Somebody listening to podcasts and reading books would not get that opportunity back then. There were not as many books and podcasts back then also. So now it's a little bit different. I had a post about a year or two ago, 2-3 years ago, actually called The Rise of the Podcast Investor, posted on LinkedIn, and I screenshotted all of the podcasts out there at that time, like 2018, 2019, that taught you how to raise equity, how to find deals, how to source deals, you know, do all the stuff, manage deals, whatever. That information is out there, and it was not out there like that when I was going through it. So you can use that and kind of say, hey, I want to go raise capital and buy deals. It might be a little more difficult in the beginning because as an investor, an accredited investor, I'm going to look at, most people look at what's your background, what's your experience, all that stuff. If you're able to say, hey, I worked at this company, I went to school here, got such and such real estate degree, worked for this company for 3 years, we syndicated equity, that conversation is going to be a lot easier than if you said, hey, I used to work in manufacturing, or I used to work for Deloitte or whatever. I was doing accounting. Now I'm getting into this. It's still a big jump. You can talk about your business success and use that. But I think having that background definitely helped me out. So it's not a one size fits all, and not everybody should go to college. I don't agree with that. Everybody has their own skills and their own desires and wants, maybe military, vocational training, apprenticeships, though you can make great money doing that kind of stuff. There's a shortage of truck drivers right now. You can make great money doing that. So there's, you know, I'm not saying that everybody has to go that route. It does definitely help. And it helps even more if you go to a top tier school, but you got to look at your plan. And that can be very difficult to do if you're in your 20s, but still there are options for you out there. So
love it. No, that's great.
Yeah.
I want to pivot the conversation a little bit here and talk about your transition from multifamily and other asset types to your focus of self-storage. Talk to us a little bit about the mindset, the time frame that that pivot took place, and your mindset around the transition.
Sure. So I was the, you know, director of acquisitions, whatever, looking for multifamily deals, mostly in the Carolinas at the time. This is 2016, 2017. We had to hit a certain preferred return and a certain IRR threshold on those deals. I won't get into what those mean. You know, go look them up if you don't know. But anyway, the deals had to hit a certain return metric. In other words, the strategy that we were using, a light value add, did not add enough juice to it in order to those deals that we're looking at in order to get to those sorts of returns. So it was kind of looking for a needle in a haystack, literally in a football field of haystacks, I guess. It was really hard to make the numbers work, but I did have two deals under contract that fell through for different reasons, but So I did have a little bit of success putting some stuff in a contract, but it is fell apart. So every time we would talk to a broker or somebody about what we were doing at the firm, the guys I worked for, they did self-storage also, maybe a couple of small deal, like 15,000 square feet. So call it 100, 150 plus or minus units. That's considered small in storage. But they were doing some smaller deals for themselves along with the multifamily stuff. So whenever we talk to somebody, they would bring up the storage stuff and everybody was excited about the storage, not quite as excited about the multifamily. So we decided to pivot and say, look, we're going to just focus on storage for now and raise a small fund and go out and buy these mom and pop facilities and improve their technology and all that stuff, the whole story there. So once I started underwriting storage, I had no idea what I was doing. Number one, as far as like we had some financials and all that, but I didn't know how to find deals. I didn't know who the brokers were. As far as like really trying to underwrite them, I had some help there, but still had to kind of figure out a lot of that on my own. And then obviously the financing piece, we had some of that, but mostly SBA loans. So we had to go out and find other sources of financing as well. So we weren't starting from scratch, but we, but me personally, I just had to like immerse myself in the industry. So once I did that, I realized number one, there's a huge opportunity in storage to consolidate facilities from what are called mom and pop owners, or maybe people who own maybe just one or two locations and they don't have like large portfolios of properties. So in multifamily, a lot of your listeners probably are familiar with multifamily. The majority, maybe 75-ish percent of all multifamily is owned by typically professional institutional groups, large private equity groups, et cetera. And maybe only 25, 30% are owned by mom and pops, right? It's the inverse, the flip in self-storage. 75%-ish are owned by mom and pops. 25-ish percent are owned by institutional groups. So there's a consolidation play. And there's other reasons too. It's really easy to raise rents 5% because it's you're talking about $5 a month versus that's a latte, you know, versus $50 a month or $75 a month in multifamily. There's other reasons, but it comes down to the business operations of it as well. And we're renting space to people. If I have to kick you out because you don't pay and auction your stuff, I don't feel bad. And that kind of ties into my background in foreclosure work. I don't want to evict people from apartments and all that. Like I just, that's just, you know, a place in my own heart. So the operations of the facility, I don't feel bad at all. It's just your stuff. And if you don't pay for it, it's going to auction, right? So the business operations, you can also manage, you can have one manager manage 400 units. I've seen it, you know, elderly retired ladies who are managing a facility that's 400 units and just her. Versus, you know, in multifamily at 400 units, you need at least probably six people, three maintenance guys and three leasing people and all that. So the operations, the overhead and all that is a bit different.
Hey, real quick, before we get back to the show, if you and I haven't connected yet, head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my investor network. From there, my team will be in touch to schedule a brief call. I'd love to connect with you and learn more about your investing goals, what you're working on, what you're looking to do in the future, and also let you know about some of the projects we're working on over at Canovo Capital. So go down into the show notes right now and click on the link or just head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my network there. And I look forward to connecting with you. Let's get back to the show. And I want to dive into some of the nuts and bolts of self-storage versus multifamily, maybe some of the challenges and unique opportunities there. But before I do, I'm curious about you partnering up with Dan and his team over at PassiveInvesting.com.
Yeah.
Maybe talk to us a little bit about, because you had partnered, you had a separate partner. You guys were building your own company focused on self-storage. Dan comes along, says, hey, why don't we work together on this? Why make that move? What advantage did that give you? Why would you make that decision when you're already in the process of carving out your own path?
Oh, it was pretty easy. So the deals we were doing were smaller, mostly focused in Charlotte, the Charlotte metro area. So we had two deals under contract. One fell out because of seller default and we lost a bunch of money on that deal. The second deal we had under contract was actually a great deal. And they happened to come in and say, hey, we can provide the equity for this deal and get it closed for you. Sign on the loan guarantees and all that stuff. So they filled that piece of needing somebody to fill that role. Now we had raised some capital and had some commitments, but Dan and his crew was able to come in and just, you know, fill the gap. And that helped us tremendously get that deal closed. Plus it just made sense as far as the vision of what we wanted to do. We wanted to go out and buy, like I always wanted to go out and buy larger institutional type deals. And now here's a way to go ahead and kind of short circuit or shortcut that process, that path, whereas it could take a couple years to try and grow to get there, right? You buy one-offs here and there and package them up, sell them, and then you take that capital and then put that into larger deals and raise more equity. That can take a long period of time to do versus partnering or with a group who has the capability there already. It just made a ton of sense. So those are the reasons why. And then I know Dan's a good guy and the team there is a great guy. So it made sense.
And so maybe I misunderstood then. You were fairly early in the development of your self-storage investing company then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So right. John Allen and I, on the self-storage side, we partnered up, like, I think at the end of 2019, we started a company. Okay. It was called Cornerstone Capital Real Estate. And we started looking for deals. We got the two under contract in 2020, during the pandemic, coincidentally. And so we were about a year in when Dan and passive investing came along.
Got it. Makes sense. Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, since then, what have you guys accomplished together with Dan and his team, PassiveInvesting.com, and you and your business partner? What have you guys acquired to date since you guys have started focusing on self-storage?
Yeah, so we closed our first fund. We raised a fund. So we did the first deal. That's outside of the fund. But we closed on 9 assets total. About $90 million in value, obviously the average of about $10 million purchase price. I think it's a total of, I forgot, like 4,500, maybe close to 5,000 units, something like that, in the Charlotte MSA out in Denver, Colorado, and near in Greenville, South Carolina. So in good markets. And then that deal, that very first deal we did, the one outside the fund that they came and helped us raise the equity and close, that one we're actually thinking about taking to market. So we've gotten some BOVs from brokers on that one, and we'll hopefully go full cycle on that this year. So we'll see. But we just quick trajectory on that front. So we're able to ramp up the operations and get going and close a bunch of deals. So we're happy. So we're able to accomplish that goal, that vision. So within about a year.
Well, let's dive into a little bit of the nuts and bolts of self-storage versus multifamily. So, as multifamily has become extremely attractive over the last handful of years. I mean, it's always been an attractive asset, but there's been a flood of interest in the multifamily space over the last 5 years. It's becoming more and more difficult to find good opportunities that pencil. And so you start to see this transition of everybody in multifamily, it's the darling of the industry, to then branching out slightly and starting to look at different asset types that can produce better yield. So one of those obviously being self-storage. There's opportunity in self-storage, mobile home parks. Even had a guest on the other day talking about parking structures. So talk to us a little bit about someone who is less familiar with self-storage, is familiar with multifamily as you were. What are some of the pros and cons of investing in self-storage versus multifamily? I know you already rattled off a few earlier about the ease of management, the eviction process, being able to raise rents incrementally that doesn't have quite as big of an impact. Is there anything else that you would add to that list that would say, you know what, this is why I really like self-storage? And then I would like to hear the challenges that you face in self-storage as well.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked about the raising rents. We talked about the consolidation play, which is possible in self-storage. We talked about, like you said, the eviction process or the, that whole thing. I think too, on the self-storage side, you'd have some of the financing options. So if you have somebody listening who wants to maybe buy their own self-storage facility, you can do that using SBA financing. So basically it's government-backed financing. Live Oak Bank is a great bank to talk to about that, but you can get a loan from the Small Business Administration and possibly purchase your own facility with as little as maybe 10 to 15% down. So you can be operating, owning 400 plus units in storage pretty quickly, depending on how much capital you have. And then the other side of it too is just the recession resistance. So on the multifamily side, it's actually easy story to tell a multifamily. Everybody needs a place to live, whether it's a recession or whether times are good, right? So it's a pretty easy story to tell and people are familiar with the operations and everybody lives in a house. You know, if you live in a house, you kind of get it, right? Okay, it's one house, but if I got like 300 units, okay, I understand that. Scale, economies of scale, et cetera. Whereas in storage, it's like, well, it's kind of a head scratcher. One is the recession resistance. So before I get to that, storage, sometimes people have a hard time understanding why in the world do people want to store their stuff in a place in a garage, essentially? Like, why don't you just get rid of it? And it's like that. It's kind of hard for people to wrap their heads around. And it's true. Usually people need storage when there's a time of change in their life. So you think of they call it like the four D's: death, divorce, dislocation, meaning you're moving, downsizing, maybe you're downsizing your space or whatever. Now they added a fifth D called decluttering, with during the pandemic, people needed to make space for work from home situations. So you have those driving factors, which don't change too often, and in fact can change even more during recessions or downturns. So to get back into the recession situation, the returns during those periods, if you download, I've talked about this in numerous places, but if you download the data, anybody listening here can go to REIT.com. You go download the data for all of the returns from every asset class, publicly traded REITs, going back to like 1990, whatever. And you can do your own little analysis and look and see in 2008 and 2009, which asset class had the best returns during the pandemic in 2020, which asset classes had the best returns. You will always see storage there at the top, if not leading the pack in returns. So as far as risk, if investors are thinking about risk and return trade-off, right? So in other words, the more return you have, there has to be some sort of inherent risk there. Self-storage is a really good risk-adjusted return when you look at it. And why is that? Well, it's because of the operations and the need. What is driving storage are those five D's, where people have some sort of change in their life causing them to need storage. You add that to the fact that when somebody moves into a unit, typically they plan on staying for 2 months, but then they end up staying for 6 or 9. About half or three quarters of your tenant base will end up staying much longer than expected, usually up to anywhere from 6 to 9 to 12 months or more, despite those rental rate increases, because they are so small. It's the cost of a latte. But that $5 increase could be a 5% increase in my pro forma, which is really good. So those are the reasoning. Hopefully that makes sense. It's not just us getting on and saying, hey, storage is great, right? It's like asking a barber, do you need a haircut? They're always going to say, yeah, you need a trim on the side, right? But anybody, third party, just go out there and look, download the data, do your own analysis, and you'll see that self-storage performs very, very well. And again, disclaimer, past performance is not an indicator of future performance, right? And those are all publicly traded REITs, but at least you can get an idea for the performance of self-storage.
Yeah, love it. And what are some of the unique challenges that you face in investing in self-storage versus maybe a little bit more typical multifamily investment?
Yeah, surprisingly, if you look at a city, you just go to apartments.com, let's say, and you type in, whatever your parameters are, you'll get like 1,000 apartment complexes that pop up, or usually more. But if you go to like some self-storage website, or just go to Google Maps and type in self-storage over your city, you might get like maybe 50 or something if you look at the whole city, right? So in other words, while there is opportunity to consolidate, there are fewer actual locations to consolidate. So you have groups, like maybe passiveinvesting.com or others who want to jump into the storage space for all of the reasons I just mentioned. And what that does is it drives up pricing and drives down cap rates. And so as a result, we have a very competitive bid process within the storage space. If we're looking at a broker deal or an on-market deal, they are getting right now, as of the time of this recording, rates are going up, et cetera. So they're seeing some groups drop out, but maybe you would get 10 to 15 offers before on one property. Now you might get 5 to 10. So you do have the groups that are in it for the long haul still bidding on properties, which still makes it a competitive process, because those groups that are bidding for the long, or owning for the long haul, I should say, they are the ones who have the capital and the ability to close the deal, right? So it's not like the strong ones have been weeded out. It's actually the weak buyers have been weeded out and the strong ones remain. So there is a lot of competition still for self-storage deals. And that is one part of the complexity of looking for and finding these deals and getting them closed. It's not easy to do so. On the other hand, too, on just the to answer a different version of the same question, on the operations side, your marketing, right, needs to be on point. If you're going to run it with a manager there, it can be hard right now to find good labor, good employees that are willing to stay and not try to charge you a whole bunch of money for their services or whatever. So it can be a little tough on that front. And then you might have the situation where if you're in a bad location, maybe it's a high crime area, you might have a lot of tenant turnover in storage because As a plus, you do have a month-to-month rental agreement, so you can adjust rates with inflation. On the downside, if you adjust rates too quickly and you go up maybe, you know, really, really high sometimes, you will have some people move out just because, hey, I don't want to pay that. You know, I don't want to pay $40 more than I was paying before, even though the facility as a whole was below market. So it is the Netflix of real estate, I call it. I heard that somewhere else. That's not my own thing, but it's like the Netflix of real estate. So it's a month to month and they can cancel any time and move out, presumably. So there are some risks to that. And those are the pros and cons, I guess I'd say.
On the financing side, obviously you have created a fund where you guys source your equity for these deals. But what are some of the nuances around obtaining financing for self-storage?
Well, it comes down to usually the debt, and it depends on, well, that's obviously financing, but it comes down, usually they have certain parameters or certain types of deals. So without getting too much in the weeds, if you're going to a certain type of lender, like a bank lender, they look for a certain debt service coverage ratio, and that's really important for them when you purchase the deal. Other types of lenders might look for what's called a debt yield, and that's more important for them when you purchase the deal. So it's a balance between what rate can I get, you know, for the dollars that I'm borrowing, for the strategy that I'm trying to employ or at this particular property, what makes sense, you know, on that front. There's still plenty of lenders that are in the storage business and they're in it for the long haul. So as far as actually being able to find lenders, that's not a problem to find a good lender on a property. It's a matter of balancing what they're looking for as far as your going in debt service coverage ratio or debt yield, and obviously your loan to value or loan to cost, and then how much money you got to raise, et cetera, and balancing that with the purchase price. So to find a lender is not difficult. And if anybody out there is looking at a deal and you say, hey, who should I talk to about financing this deal? Usually the lender that already has a note on the property is the best place to start and talk to that lender and see if they want to keep it on their books. Oftentimes they do, and see, you know, if you can strike a deal with them. If not, contact a debt broker on the storage front and they can help you find whatever loan you might need to find. If it's a smaller deal, you might just start calling some local banks because they know the market pretty well and should be able to give you good pricing on that.
If there's one specific metric that sort of stands above all the others to help you identify at a high level if an opportunity is one that you want to sink your teeth into and really pursue, what metric is that that you're really targeting?
Really, I look at a couple of things. One is the market first. So where is it located? That's probably not the exact answer you're looking for, but generally speaking, we look at the market first. Where is it located? Is it in a growing submarket of one of the major MSAs in the Southeast, Texas, Colorado, Arizona? That's where we want to be. We want to be where people are moving to. We don't want to be where people are exiting from. And so market first, and then I look at a little closer at the deal, size of the deal, 50,000 square feet and above. That if that checks that box, okay, because that's a good size for the equity raise. It doesn't waste our time. And it's a good size in case we want to, whatever we got to do as far as operationally, there is a good amount of capital to be able to put to work, to be able to improve the property if necessary. Sometimes it can be harder on a smaller deal to be able to do what you want to do just because you're constrained by the cash flows and the size, et cetera. We always want to be able to exit to an institutional group. So 50,000 square feet and above will get us there on the exit. We have gotten calls from some institutional groups saying, hey, if you're thinking about selling any of these deals you own, give us a call because we'd love to buy them from you. So that checks that box. If I actually got into the numbers and the underwriting of it, I would look at obviously there a couple things. One is their expense ratio in storage. I didn't mention this earlier, but in storage, if you're at the 50,000 square foot and above mark, your expenses are roughly 30%-ish plus or minus of your effective gross income. So actual dollars that you bring in, not the gross potential, but the actual money you bring in, your expense ratio is roughly 30-ish percent of that. That expense ratio grows the smaller the property, which makes sense, right? So that expense ratio, how are they running it? And then the rents, the comps in the market, where are they at right now? If they're right there at the top of the market, there probably isn't much meat on the bone. In other words, if a 10 by 10, which is a common size, let's just say that the comps are $100 for a 10 by 10 non-climate controlled, meaning not indoor, not air conditioned, non-climate, just like a drive up where you drive your car up, open the door, put your stuff in and then drive off. So a 10 by 10 non-climate unit is renting for $100 and the subject property or the one that you're targeting to purchase is renting for $95. There probably isn't much room right there to improve things and get the rents up. Like there isn't much of a story there, but if they're well below market, maybe 15-ish% or so below market. Well, maybe there's some room there. Okay, let's look at the rents. Let's look at the current rents and compare the two, the rents in the market with the comps and the current rents. Let's look at their operations and see how they're running things, and then try to make the other pieces fit as far as the debt piece and how much equity we have to raise, et cetera. So expense ratio and the rents, the rent comps, where are they at in the market?
Love it. Well, Chris, this has been a great conversation thus far. I want to start winding down here and be mindful of your time. Sure. I've got a few final questions for you before we end. The first one is, right now, what's the biggest challenge that you're facing right now in your business that we could all learn from?
It's always deal flow. We need more deals to look at, right? So on market, off market, the bigger our funnel, right? So the more deals that we have to look at that go into the hopper at the very top. We only do a certain percentage of those, close a certain percentage of those. So maybe 2-5% of all the deals we look at, we actually end up putting under contract and then getting it closed. So if we can always widen the top of the funnel, put more deals in it, theoretically, we should close more deals. And so that's always a problem.
And how do you address that? And how are you addressing that currently? To find more deals?
Yeah. So obviously broker relations, since we've closed in the beginning, man, it's really tough. It's really hard in the beginning to try and get traction with brokers because they hear it. Like, they'll go to the conferences, the trade shows, and they'll meet with like 10, 15 groups that say they want to get into the business, and then nothing ever happens with them. So when I was going around, most of them knew me from before, but we were targeting larger deals. And so when you start doing that, it's like you're playing in a whole nother ball game, right? You're going from maybe a lower A or triple A baseball up to, you know, the pros, which is a whole different level. And so to compete there and actually be successful in the beginning is very difficult. But beyond that, once you close a few deals, you get early looks at deals from brokers before they take it to market. So trying to work those relationships. Really, I used to source deals off market, make phone calls. Like literally, I called every storage facility and every multifamily location between Charlotte and Raleigh, North Carolina. That's a ton of work to close maybe 2 or 3 deals in a year. On the self-storage side, because they're smaller, you don't make a ton of money doing that on the smaller mom and pop stuff. So you got to go bigger. So really, the best way to capitalize on your time is brokers and actually keeping those relationships going. And then beyond that, I have relationships with some of the, you know, whether it be CEOs or whatever, acquisitions guys, disposition guys at some of the top shops. And so you always keep in contact with them. And they have sent us deals to look at and say, hey, we're thinking about selling this one. What would you price this one at, et cetera. So we have those relationships with owners to be able to purchase their properties as well. So it does happen. Yeah.
Love it. Yep. Well, Chris, again, thank you for coming on the show. Thanks for sharing your personal journey with us and some of the insights and strategies and tactics that you've learned along the way. Before I let you go, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and learn more about what you have going on?
Absolutely. LinkedIn is going to be good. Just Google or search on LinkedIn, Chris Bennett, K-R-I-S. And the same on Facebook. I have a public profile, so you can connect with me there as well.
Okay. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So if you've enjoyed our conversation with Chris, go down in the show notes right now, click on that link, and connect up with Chris. Chris, thank you again so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. And we look forward to connecting with you again down the road.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Hey, before you go, if you and I haven't connected yet, please head on over to canovocapital.com. You can join our investor network or download our free Passive Investor's Guide to Multifamily Syndications. Either way, I'd love to connect with you personally. Also, I just want to thank you for listening to the show and providing feedback and reviews. If you haven't already, please, please, please take a second and leave us a rating and written review. This helps us to be found by new listeners and helps us attract great guests in the future. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great day.